This is the State of Things from Duke Chapel in Durham, North Carolina. I'm Frank Stacio. In the past few decades, Duke University has built a reputation as an academic and research powerhouse that is home to the world-renowned scholars, thinkers, and social activists that live here and go to school. And at the heart of this burgeoning university is the Duke Chapel, an iconic building that's been around since the university got its name. The chapel is a grand and Gothic structure that sits between the residential and academic quads of Duke's West Campus. It symbolically bridges the gap between students' personal lives and their scholarly intellectual pursuits. We're here today recording a special show in front of a live audience for the official reopening of the chapel. It's been closed for the past year for renovation, and joining me first is Duke University archivist Valerie Gillespie. She recently participated in a project that digitized more than 2,500 Duke Chapel sermons. Valerie Gillespie, welcome to the State of Things.
Thank you.
So for those who have never seen it, please start by describing this beautiful building for us.
Well, it's the sort of building that when you walk in, it takes your breath away a little bit. It's enormously tall, vaulted ceilings, beautiful woodwork, dazzling stained glass windows, and it's been just a wonderful treat to be able to re-enter it after it being closed for over a year.
So talk about its construction. When was it built? How long did it take?
Sure. The chapel was built between 1930 and 1932. The West Campus of Duke University was built in the late 1920s. The chapel was sort of the centerpiece, the last thing to go in. And so we have pictures of students on the campus as the tower of the chapel is being constructed under scaffolding. The chapel was completed in 1932, but it wasn't dedicated until 1935.
Tell us about this Gothic structure. I mean, it's pretty common. It doesn't look unusual for a church and a chapel, but how common was it for Methodist universities or other religious universities to employ this kind of architecture back in the 1930s?
I think it was a little bit unusual, and it was certainly influenced by the look of other university campuses, both in Europe and in the United States. Some of the administrators at Duke had traveled and looked at other campuses and noted what they admired about those campuses, places like Princeton and University of Chicago that are well known for their Gothic architecture, and they noted that they wanted something similar here in Durham.
We need to take a step back because this was not always Duke University. We know that at one point it was Trinity College, and it wasn't even in Durham. So give us the rough history of how this came to be Duke University and in Durham.
Sure. What we know as Duke University began as a literal one-room schoolhouse in Randolph County in the late 1830s. It grew into Trinity College by the 1850s, and it was a small, fairly rural school. By the 1890s, they knew that they wanted to move to a more urban area to attract more students and faculty and support, and they wound up coming to Durham in 1892. From 1892 to 1924, it was known as Trinity College, and it's located at today's East Campus. That was the entire school. In 1924, James B. Duke, whose family had been involved in the college for many years, established the Duke Endowment, which is a charitable trust. And one of the main beneficiaries of that endowment was Trinity College, which was quickly renamed Duke University.
Tell us how much that is in 2016 dollars.
So the amount of funding that came in from the endowment in James B. Duke in 1924 and 1925 was about $19 million. In today's money, that would be closer to $300 million.
Yeah, I would name myself Duke for that. But it's an interesting story in the family's history. The idea that Trinity College wanted to come to a more urban area makes sense. The fact that Durham was that urban area, again, has something to do with the Duke family, who by then had a fairly thriving business called the American Tobacco Company, the largest exporter of any commodity in the world by that time. That's why this is an urban area. But the involvement of the Duke family, not only in the endowment, but James Duke's father, Washington Duke, was involved in a kind of revolutionary provision that he wanted to see. When Trinity College came here, he wanted to make certain that this was open to almost all.
Yeah, when the school moved in 1892, it was still primarily a school for men. There were a few female day students. But in 1896, Washington Duke wrote a letter to the president and said that he would give an additional endowment if the school admitted women on equal footing with men.
And what year was this?
That was in 1896. So by 1897, Trinity College was a coeducational school, a very early one.
Fascinating story about the architecture of Duke University and the building in which we are sitting now. Tell us about Julian Abel.
Sure. Julian Abel was the chief designer in the Horace Trumbauer firm, and the Trumbauer firm was employed to design both the East and West campus after the Duke Endowment was established. Julian Abel was the first African-American graduate of the University of Pennsylvania's architecture program. He had been extensively educated in Europe, and then he came and joined Horace Trumbauer's firm in Philadelphia beginning in 1906.
Studied in Europe for a while.
Studied in Europe prior to joining the firm. And then when he worked with Trumbauer, some of the buildings they worked on were for the Duke family, James B. Duke's homes in New York and Newport among them. And when it was time to design a brand new university, the Trumbauer firm was sort of the natural selection, and Julian Abel was the chief designer.
Now, it's interesting that an African-American architect would design this place and frankly would not at that point have been allowed on the campus. At least in his professional capacity, right?
That's right. It was a segregated campus for students at that time. And Julian Abel was very much in the background for many years. It was known to a few administrators what his story was, but most people did not realize there was a black architect behind Duke Chapel.
And as you say, for decades, really, that story had not been told. Interestingly enough, his role in construction, as you say, was relatively unknown. And then there's a story, in a sense, about how people found out about him, and it had to do with anti-apartheid demonstrations on this campus, right?
That's right. In 1986, there were shanty towns erected on the quad right outside of the chapel, and these were meant to demonstrate against apartheid and against investments in companies that did business in South Africa. Someone wrote a letter to the editor of the school paper saying, I think it's really too bad that the look of our campus is being blighted. I don't think the original designers would have wanted to see that. And Susan Cook, who was the great-grandniece of Julian Abel and a student at Duke, wrote in and said, well, actually, the designer of the campus was black, and I think he would understand why we are doing this.
Fascinating story. And also, when we think of the homilist and the number of people who have given homilies at the pulpit where we're seated right now, there are many, including Bishop Desmond Tutu, who came to this campus to talk about apartheid. Let's hear part of his talk.
And so the evil of the system at home is not so much the pain and the anguish that it causes, great as these must be, as they indeed are. The awful thing about apartheid, the most blasphemous thing about it, is when it makes a child of God doubt that they are a child of God. And so the most subversive thing about our faith is that it can say to someone who has their dignity rubbed in the dust and is trampled underfoot, hey, you know something, mama? That old lady walking down the dusty streets of Soweto, whose name is not known by her employers because they say her real name is too difficult and so they will call her Annie. Mama, as you walk down the street and they ask, who is that? You say, oh, that's God's partner. That is subversive of injustice and oppression.
There's a clip from a 1982 speech delivered by Bishop Desmond Tutu at Duke Chapel, and we're recording a special show at Duke Chapel in front of a live audience celebrating the chapel's reopening. This building has played an important part. It has been the focus of many demonstrations and many important moments of change in the university, hasn't it?
Yeah, it's really the central building that you see as you come up Chapel Drive, and it kind of looms ahead of you with the tower right in front. It has been the site of demonstrations following Martin Luther King's assassination in 1968. There was a very large silent vigil for about 4 days where students came out, both in an act of mourning and in support of hourly laborers on campus. The Chapel Quad is sort of a natural gathering place for students and the community whenever something major has happened.
Tell us a bit about some of the structural elements, too. Let's start with these windows.
Sure. The windows were designed by G. Owen Bonawit, who was a stained glass designer. He worked with 14 other people to work on these windows for almost 3 years, the entire construction time of the chapel. The windows depict scenes from both the Old and New Testament. They have really only 6 colors of glass in them, but they're so beautifully arranged that you see a real rainbow of color.
Duke University archivist Valerie Gillespie. Valerie, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
We'll continue our conversation about the Duke Chapel just ahead and talk more about the memorable historic moments that have happened inside these walls. But first, the music of the Duke Chapel Choir, conducted by Rodney Weinkoop. This is the State of Things broadcasting from Duke Chapel in Durham, North Carolina. I'm Frank Stasio. We are talking about the history of the chapel to celebrate its reopening after a year of renovations. The chapel's grand architecture has attracted visitors and worshipers from all over. Meanwhile, its prestigious pulpit has hosted some of the world's best-known preachers, including Desmond Tutu and Howard Thurman. But what is the role of a religious chapel on a modern university campus? And what, if any, role should it play in the larger community outside of Duke? Joining me now to talk about preaching inside the chapel and the chapel's programs is Reverend Dr. Luke Powery, who is the dean of Duke Chapel. Welcome to the program, Dr. Powery. Dean Powery, I have heard you refer to this chapel as an enchantment. What do you mean?
It is, as Valerie said earlier, as you walk into this spiritual space, lifts you higher. As an icon of the university, it's a window in the religious sense, a window into deeper realities. And in many ways, you meet God, whether it's through the windows or through the sacred sounds of the chapel choir or, heaven forbid, the preaching. You encounter the divine. You encounter someone who is our creator, redeemer, and sustainer.
You're a professor of homiletics. Tell us what that is, and again, how the characteristics of a chapel like this, do they play into the way you would structure your homily?
Sure. Homiletics is, my definition is the theological study of the art of preaching. So it is both theological and rhetorical. And as we've learned this year, being outside of this beautiful neo-Gothic architecture and being in Baldwin Auditorium and Page Auditorium, that architecture does influence the liturgy, does influence preaching. I wouldn't say it necessarily impacts the structure, but the feeling, the mood of a sermon, one's own pace, perhaps. One's, not necessarily the story, but in terms of how one performs, and I mean form coming through, the sermon form in the larger sense, the embodiment of that sermon, is definitely impacted by the space in which you preach.
This place has invited some prominent speakers, many of whom have been deeply engaged in their time. Howard Thurman is one. Maybe you should tell us a little bit about who he is. He preached here in the late 70s, right?
He did. Howard Thurman preached in Duke Chapel in the 1970s. And in fact, I was told that he was, through some archival research, he was actually invited. He's an African-American theologian, pastor, deemed to be a pastor to many of the civil rights leaders. He was invited by a committee in the 1950s to preach at Duke Chapel. At that time, Duke was not integrated, and so we couldn't find any materials in terms of discovering why he never came, but he did come in the 1970s. But back in the 50s, Howard Thurman was the dean of the chapel at Marsh Chapel at Boston University. He was also the first dean of the chapel at Howard University. And so in some ways, in many ways, from interviews, many of the civil rights leaders, like Otis Moss Jr., considered him to be their mentor, spiritual mentor. He wasn't on the streets with them marching, but he was their thought leader, their pastor behind the scenes.
Was he dean at BU at Boston University when Martin Luther King was there?
He was still dean of the chapel when Dr. King, before he was Dr. King, entered the PhD program at the latter part of Thurman's time at Boston. That's when Dr. King came. But Thurman was in college with Daddy King, Martin Luther King Sr. And the story, the oral history is that Dr. King traveled around in his briefcase with Howard Thurman's book, Jesus and the Disinherited. So there's great influence.
He, as I said, was invited to speak here, and we have a portion of Howard Thurman's sermon. We're about to hear the meditation portion of the sermon. Maybe before we hear it, you should tell us structurally what that means, the meditation portion.
Well, Howard Thurman, in many ways, he was a Baptist minister, but very different. He was known as a mystic prophet, and he was experimental as a dean of the chapel, particularly at Howard. And so the sermonic moment, if we think of it as a whole, would begin with a prayer, and then he would have this section that he calls meditation, which might be a reading of some other sort, of poetry or prose, and then you would get to the standard sermon. And so this is what Thurman would call the meditation.
It is good to remember that God has not left himself without a witness in our lives. Despite all the wanderings of our footsteps, despite all the ways by which we may have sought to circumvent the truth within us, despite all the weaknesses of our spirits and of our minds, despite all the blunders by which we may have isolated ourselves from our fellows or proven unworthy of the love, the trust, the confidence by which again and again our days are surrounded, despite all these things, it is good to remember that God has not left himself without a witness in our spirits and in our lives. Forgive us our debts as we forgive our debtors. This is the timeless utterance, the password that relaxes the angel with the flaming sword who guards the entrance to the Holy of Holies. No man can be happy in heaven if his brother is in hell.
That's a clip from Howard Thurman's sermon at the Duke Chapel. Howard Thurman, mentor to many of the civil rights leaders in the 1960s. This talk was given at Duke Chapel in 1979, and I'm talking to Reverend Luke Powery, who is the dean of Duke Chapel. It raises the question we heard earlier from Bishop Desmond Tutu. Again, these are activists and also men of the spirit. What's the role of a chapel like this in a modern university?
Here at Duke Chapel, I would say there are three roles at least. Particularly at Duke, the Duke Chapel is the icon of the university, and it serves, you know, many purposes as it relates to university events, convocations, etc. It is also a vibrant center of worship. There's the Christian church, vibrant community, and it is also a sanctuary for all people. And as the dean of the chapel and my colleague, Associate Dean Christy Lohr-Sapp, we are conveners and facilitators of all of the religious life groups, which are multi-faith. But the heart of our mission in particular, which I think for a major research university, it really gets to the heart, is bridging faith and learning, which at Duke taps into the deep root of thinking about the integration of knowledge and piety, or eruditio et religio. How can we help students? How can we help faculty members, staff members, the wider community think about the integration of our intellectual lives and our spiritual lives, right? That we are not just a head on a stack of books, but we are whole people. And how can we think about our hands and our hearts and praying with our feet, as Abraham Heschel would say?
That gets to be tricky business when you try to, again, put it on the ground. And I wonder what you take away from the controversy over the call to prayer, from the proposition that there be Muslim call to prayer from this building. Ultimately, that idea was withdrawn by the university, but there was a great deal of controversy over it, and I think still some deep feelings about it. What do you take away from that controversy?
I take away that in many ways there's still work to be done as it relates to interfaith relationships and interfaith understanding. But also, I think there's a lot to be said for the need for intra-Christian relationships and intra-Christian understanding and how those two intersect. In the time in which we live and at a major research university where we're hoping to educate students to be global leaders, global citizens, it is vital for any student to have a sense, a capacity of interfaith literacy, interfaith understanding, and interfaith friendships and relationships in order to be a fruitful citizen, not only on this campus, but in the world, especially as we see the student population in particular at Duke diversifying culturally, religiously, ethnically.
Well, I want to invite a student into the conversation right now who does specialize and think very deeply about those kind of conversations. Yiying Tay is a graduating senior at Duke University. She's involved in the chapel's student ministry called Pathways, where she was a chapel scholar. Yiying was also Duke Chapel's student preacher this past spring. Welcome to the program, Yiying. Good to have you here. Also with me is Brandon Hudson. He's the director of the nonprofit Urban Hope in Durham, also a graduate of Duke, and participated in Duke Chapel's Pathways Fellowship, and that included a year-long residency in the Pathways House. Brandon, welcome to you. Good to have you here.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Yiying, I want to start with you because I know that in some ways this interfaith dialogue is very important to you. Tell us about your involvement in that.
So I am the co-president of Duke Voices for Interfaith Action on campus. It used to be called Duke Undergraduate Faith Council, and we're a pretty young organization, but especially after the chapel controversy, we realized there was a great need for interfaith engagement on this campus. A lot of Muslim students felt very unsafe on campus, and I have Muslim friends who pray in the stairwells in the library because they do not have a prayer room to pray in previously. And so we realized the deep need and hunger for interfaith engagement on this campus. And so we held an interfaith dialogue workshop a few months after the controversy, and 60 people, many who were leaders of religious life organizations on campus, turned up and told their stories and told the told about the times they felt unsafe on this campus, or what their faith meant to them, how it looked like in their lived realities on this campus, and it really broke down barriers. And I think those relationships still continue on today.
When you say it broke down barriers, how do we see that? How do you see that manifest outside of the conversations that you have?
I think it really manifests in when there was protests in AVU this semester, protesting an administrator's alleged abuse of a worker. A lot of people out there were people of faith, and they use music, they use quotes from religious leaders they really admired to push the movement forward, and that was an example of an organic interfaith movement that happened. It wasn't advocated by Duke Voices for Interfaith Action, but it was something that was, it just came about because people of faith cared about the issue.
Well, and then once you see that your faith is an active thing, that it's about activism, it may be about protest at times, sometimes it's about silence, but in all cases, it's about being with your feet on the ground. Brandon, tell us a little bit about Pathways, and again, these are all conversations that are happening on campus, but Pathways is a deliberate, intentional effort to get Duke off the campus and into the community. Tell us about Pathways.
Yeah, the Pathways Fellowship Program is designed for young alumni and to have them spend a year in intentional Christian community together. So we live in a house in the West End community here in Durham, and the goal is to work in some kind of church or nonprofit organization, getting a sense of the issues and challenges that folks face here in the Durham community, and then also having the opportunity to take courses at the Divinity School, so to be able to reflect theologically on those kind of feet on the ground situations that you're involved in. And my time in Pathways really allowed me to understand better where my calling was. One of the many mantras that the chapel has had is keeping the heart of the university, listening to the heart of God. And I think what it means to listen to the heart of God is to listen to the voices of those who are oppressed and marginalized, who don't have space at the table. The Julian Abels, if you have it, the George Walls, if you will. The history was so great that Valerie offered, because in Trinity College, when it first came here, George Wall was a guy who was working on that campus in Randolph County. He was asked to move here to Durham when the university moved. And Walltown, the neighborhood I'm in, is named after him. That's the area where he settled and has historically been home to workers here at the university or in the mills. And so, you know, it's been an opportunity for me to see how the folks who've been oppressed or marginalized, voices left out of the table, who've lived in Walltown, how can we work with them to build on the assets and strengths that are there, and to bring them into the conversation that folks at Duke and the broader part of the city are having.
Yi-Ying, you gave a homily, a sermon here at the chapel. You were the student preacher this spring, right? Can you tell us about your homily?
My homily was titled "Everybody's Got the Blues," and it was basically a reflection of how often we put down people's suffering, labeling it as unimportant or belittling them. But my point was that everybody's got the blues, regardless of what shade of blue, whether it's Carolina blue or Duke blue, God cares about your blues. And so that was, it was really wonderful, because a lot of my friends came, and it felt like that the sermon wasn't a sermon that came from me. It came from my community of people who were of the Christian faith or of a different faith, and they were all part of that sermon because they supported me through my own suffering. And as they were in the audience, I felt like they were the ones that were preaching to me, because the content of the sermon came from them, really.
Well, Dean Power, tell me how homiletics has changed, if it has, given the impulse to interfaith dialogue that we're seeing. If this is really a movement, if there is more of it, and you can correct me if I'm wrong if it's not true, and what we're hearing in Yi-Ying's testimony here is a kind of pervasive spirit on the campus and elsewhere, how does it change homiletics? How does it change how you preach when you're thinking about a bigger world and more religious traditions when you design your sermon?
Yeah, that's a great question, Frank. I think thinking about preaching in an interfaith world or interfaith context is really a growing edge overall, I would say. in terms of university chapels. There are some university chapels, some of our peers, that I think are doing some wonderful things as it relates to interfaith. As you think about preaching, for me, I think it has to do with humanity. It has to do with, before we are any category of faith or no faith, or the duns and the nuns and the ones, that we are human beings, that we are created in the image of God. And so whether it's the blues, the suffering, or whether it's the celebrations like today, right, the full spectrum, being at full stretch and what it means to be a human being, the key as it pertains to preaching, interfaith or not, is really paying attention, having an eye to the human condition, and remembering that we all come from dust, and to dust we will return.
My guests are the Reverend Luke Powery, Brandon Hudson, and Yi Ying Tay. Reverend Powery, the Dean of Duke Chapel. Brandon Hudson, Director of the nonprofit Urban Hope in Durham. And Yi Ying Tay, a graduating senior at Duke, involved in Duke Chapel's Pathway Student Ministry. Thank you so much for being on the program. We're recording our program before a live audience at Duke Chapel. We will return to the state of things in just a moment and hear about the legacy of the Duke Chapel Choir, but first, we'll hear more of their music. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio, recording in front of a live audience at Duke Chapel in Durham, North Carolina. We're here today to celebrate the reopening of this historic building, and we're going to talk now about a group that has called this building home since the 1930s. The Duke Chapel Choir is the largest and most visible music group in the chapel, and it's comprised of more than 90 students and community members. They perform as a regular part of the 11 a.m. Sunday worship service, and 62 of them are here today. Let's give them a warm round of applause. You've heard a sample of their music earlier. We will hear more in a moment, but first I'm joined by the choir's conductor, Rodney Weinkoop. Rodney, welcome to the State of Things, Rodney. Tell us more about the history of this choir.
The choir existed as early as the university was being built. There were services here. The choir sang even before there was a roof on top. Often a community gathered together, 150 singers, one of the first services here, townspeople and students and the like. And one of the first things they ever sang here was, "The heavens are telling the glory of God." And it has existed as a community group, both students and non-students, ever since.
Well, that's an interesting point right there, that it is students and non-students and community members, as you say, all blended to make this choir, right?
And one of the great things about that is that it's like an extended family. We have generations of people in the choir. And it doesn't matter to us, you know, what religion you are, if you even have a religion. It doesn't matter what age you are or what profession. It doesn't even matter whether you're part of Duke or not. We just bring people together who love to make music in worship, and it works beautifully. And students will tell us sometimes that they talk to some of the older people in the choir, and they even call them grandpa or grandma, and the older folks make them feel so comforted and welcome. They ask about their homework, and It's like a living, breathing community.
That's great. Did you do your homework? Because if not, you're not going to sing. No. Well, I wonder if we can hear a sample right now.
This is actually going to be a spiritual called Give Me Jesus, arranged by Larry Fleming.
Give Me Jesus, performed by the Duke Chapel Choir under the direction of Rodney Weinkoop. It's a beautiful, beautiful song. How do you decide what you're going to perform on a given Sunday?
We start with what are the readings for the day, the biblical readings for the day, and whether there are any special occasions, either university or church year, and try to find readings that amplify or make connections with those readings. Try over the course of the year to sing in a whole variety of different musical styles for the education that we're doing as a part of singing and rehearsing. Try to do a mixture of things that we've done in the past and things that are new. So we keep exploring repertoire, new ways of connecting with people and helping people worship.
How do you cope with the, and I don't mean cope with, but deal with the acoustics? I'm wondering if you would change the arrangements or some of the, do you tell your altos to tone it down if you go someplace else, if you're playing at Page versus here? I don't know.
Yes. Yeah. We do a lot of that. So we've spent the past year in Page Auditorium, which is quite different acoustically. Every little difference between two singers in Page is quite audible. And in here, some of those differences are smoothed out by the billowing acoustic. Right? So this building presents challenges to us, as well as making some things perhaps more beautiful. The challenges include trying to keep things together. We would not want you to hear what happened a week ago when we tried for the first time in this space, having not done it for a year, just to stay together and not give in to being a part of this wave of sound that goes out there, but really to be together at the impulse of each pitch and things
well,
like that.
Now that you've got your act together, would you do another one for
sure.
us? Thank you.
Thank you.
That's the Duke Chapel Choir performing Ave Verum Corpus during our special recording from the Duke Chapel in celebration of its reopening, and I'm joined by the group's conductor, Rodney Weinkoop. I'm curious to know how, with an ensemble this large and the variety that you say we've heard a spiritual, now we hear a tune like Ave Verum Corpus, and you Handel's Messiah is something that you do every year. What's your approach? How do you, because each of those kinds of, and every one of those types of music has its own feel. How do you approach that?
There are several answers. One is start from the idea that the human voice is the instrument with the most infinite array of colors possible. And we're not really interested in having people sing the same way in one piece and in another, but to find multiplicity of tone colors and ways the voice resonates and moves. Also, of course, we're going to change the way we articulate things. How smooth is it? How marked is it? And so forth. But then, of course, we have the advantage over a lot of other kinds of music in that we have words with meaning and resonance, especially if they're related to something that's happening in the worship service. So we will talk about what those words mean, how the composer has taken these words and given them some way of helping us understand them and take meaning from them. So it's a language that we're using, and not everybody speaks the language in the same way, but we try to come in rehearsal with ways that we can all relate to it, no matter what our background is.
Talking with the Duke Chapel Choir, who will sing us out. The choir is a group of more than 90 students and community members who perform weekly under the conduction of Rodney Weinkoop. You can find out more about the history of Duke Chapel and all of my guests today at our website, stateofthings.org. The State of Things is produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Will Michaels, and Charlie Shelton Orman. Our technical directors are Jeff Anderson and Al Wadarski. Brent Wolf is WUNC's news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stasio. Once again, the Duke Chapel Choir.
We would like to close with the way we close every worship service here, which is God Be in My Head. It's a blessing written by John Rutter.